Intertextual Cardboard Experience.
Hello and welcome to Intertextual Cardboard Experience. Extremely excited for our tricktastic 22nd guest, Daniel Newman. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for being on. I think with a lot of my guests, I always have questions swirling around in my mind for some time. So I've had some questions for you for a bit. And
awesome.
And I think the timing is awesome because you're doing a lot of really cool things that I'm looking forward to talking about today as well. So
yeah, I've got a few irons and a few fires.
Yeah, I know. That seems to be always the case. And yeah, I mean, with the people that I'm talking to, and sure. I'm here for it to hear about it. But we'll kind of get things started, just thinking about some background and trajectory types of questions. But I kind of want to hear about your background and in gaming and board gaming, and you know what sort of things that you played in your formative years that have influenced your design ethos.
Sure. I mean, you know, fairly typical story. Growing up playing, you know, mass market games like Monopoly and Clue. And I remember my first real memory of playing a game was my parents playing Trivial Pursuit after I'd gone to bed and me wanting to like get in the game. And they were like, oh, you won't know any of these questions. And then like I answered one of them and they were like, okay, I guess you can stick around. I think it was like about ET or something. I don't know. And then the very first game that was mine was some Care Bears game that a friend of mine didn't want anymore. But like, I just loved the feel of the pieces and like, you know, and I would just sit and play by myself, which I did a lot actually growing up. It was hard for me to get folks to play games with for some reason. And I would just sit and play games like multi-handed in my room by myself. And I just enjoyed like the process of going through the games, it's funny because I don't really play solo games anymore. I don't find that very satisfying, but as a kid, I did a lot of that. And I was always wanted to find new games. And I would just, sit and play them by myself, which is kind of sad, but also, I don't know. I feel like there was something to get out of it. And then I got into kind of more modern games when I moved to New York, early 2000s. And somebody, my brother-in-law, I think, introduced me to Settlers of Catan. And that kind of blew my head wide off. And I organized I got on Craigslist because that was the thing at the time in like 2002, 2003. And I set up a, hey folks, come over to my house and play Settlers meetup. And I got like about a dozen people. And one of the guys was really into the German game scene at the time and would bring over other stuff. So I learned like Power Grid and Princess of Florence and like all those kind of older Euros. And that kind of set me off on that path. And that group lasted for about a year, which was pretty cool. So like when I first went up to New York, so it was a great way to meet folks. And then, I just kind of moved on from there. Started designing in like 2014, 2015, I think. And got really, you know, back into, I had taken a little break from kind of Euro games for a while. We had a kid in 2009 and we kind of stepped away from stuff because that was keeping us busy. And then, we got back into gaming and I started designing. I mean, that's kind of my whole trajectory. That might've been more than you were looking for, but there you go. History of my gaming.
No, I have a bunch of takeaways, but a couple of main ones when you talked about doing the solo or multi-handed stuff, I mean, that comprises about 50% of what I still do. So I don't think it's sad at the very least.
That's good.
And I was just kind of curious too, because, you know, and this can kind of like segue into the next question pretty well too. But I was just curious because a lot of the work that you're doing with your designs and New Mill are definitely, you know, in the smaller box card game space.
Yeah.
So I was just curious if, you know, like there are definitely, you know, families that will, you know, play those kind of like traditional card games. And I was just wondering if that was like a part of your past at all or anything.
So I learned Spades and Hearts, I think when I was in high school, and I actually had a class in high school, that there was a group of, it was German 4, I think. And there were a couple of us that were just like not having trouble with the work. So we would kind of finish the work early. And then we got permission from the teacher to just go sit in the corner and play cards while everybody else was doing like their practice work or whatever that we just didn't need. So we had like a regular, I think it was Hearts. Now that I'm thinking about it, I think we had a regular Hearts game in German class. But it, my family didn't really play traditional card games. I remember one time my grandparents were visiting and my dad was setting up to play Pinochle. And he showed me like the all the meld lists for Pinochle and was just like, this is a lot to remember. And I played once maybe. But yeah, not a lot of traditional games growing up. Just like your Milton Bradley and that kind of stuff.
Okay. Nice. So yeah, kind of like I said, in that transition spot then too. So your design and New Mill are, like I said, in the smaller box card game space. When do you feel like that's kind of like when you transitioned to in your like design and main hobby interests?
Yeah, I mean, I started out doing more like Euros because that was kind of what I was interested in playing. And then what happened? We started the New Mill thing. It was Tony Miller and I during the pandemic. So we weren't going to conventions. We weren't seeing other designers. And we both wanted to kind of feel connected to the community still. And we had a couple of designs that were a little smaller that we had pitched to a bunch of publishers. And we often got this response of like, oh, this is really cool. We really like it a lot, but it's not going to fit with what we do. So Tony and I was like, well, why don't we try to do these ourselves? This was back when Twitter was actually useful before it kind of imploded. And he and I both had a pretty big following and a lot of engagements. So we're like, well, why don't we just lean on our Twitter following and see what happens? You know, start a Kickstarter, use these couple of games that are pretty much done and see how it goes. So the Science and Seance Society was my first one, which was actually an older design of mine. It was two player only, like asymmetrical gameplay. So the two players are doing very different things, but kind of interacting with each other. And it did fairly well. So then we did his game next, which did okay. And then we started looking for like friends of ours who had stuff that would fit in this. It was really about this one box size that fit in a small priority mailer. So we didn't have to pay for packaging and it was very easy to just like slide it in. We did a couple more of those. And then I'm trying to remember what happened with Reapers, which was my first trick taking game design. But I think I'd always liked Spades and Hearts, and there were a couple other trick taking games I'd played. And I thought it'd be fun to kind of work on a trick taking game. And it really kind of, I don't know, something about that space really excited me. And then shortly after I designed that, I learned about all of the games that were coming out of Japan and Korea. And it's like really interesting stuff with trick taking. And then I kind of went down that rabbit hole and pivoted the company to only do trick taking games. And like, it kind of took off from there. And then Tony kind of stepped away because what we were doing, like, he was getting very busy with work. I had stopped working and realized that I could be doing the whole thing myself. And because I was pivoting away from what we were doing originally and I had made all these contacts in Japan, like it just made more sense for me to kind of carry it on my own. And that's where I'm at now.
Ah.
Did that answer your question? I'm not sure that actually answered your question.
No.
Maybe it did.
Okay. Oh, yeah. No, that was perfect. Okay. Yeah. Right, cool. 100%. No, that makes a ton of sense to me, and it definitely answered the question.
All right, good.
But transitioning super well too. Here's a point where I think this transitions well, and then my organization for these things is kind of all over the place. But this is a good spot for this question, in my opinion. So kind of like oddly, I've read the about page on the New Mill Industries website quite a bit.
Okay.
I it's that first sentence on the about page that it kind of sticks out to me and is a genesis for some of the questions I have for you.
Sure.
But it states that New Mill Industries is a boutique publisher with a punk rock ethos who produces small print runs of games that feature clean design and quirky themes without all the excesses of the modern board game publishing industry. So for someone who hasn't, or even has, I mean, obviously I have a few of your games. Well, a few publish one of your games.
Oh, nice.
Published ones, yeah. Right there. Like I think they have, definitely like an ethos as stated, but how would you describe the the punk rock ethos of New Mill Industries.
So I went back and forth about that. It's really more just like an attitude of not wanting to do things the way everybody else is doing them, and kind of taking more of looking at ways to do stuff that's a little less traditional. Like, so we use a print on demand printer essentially, and we do smaller print runs, and they cost us a little more. We don't make as much on it, but to me it's less about making money doing it and more about like getting cool weird stuff out there, and that feels pretty punk to me. And it's funny, like I've had discussions with other publishers, and it takes me a while to get across like what it is we're doing, because they're like, well, why don't you do it this way? Like, why don't you print more? Like, why don't you pay for it? Like, and it's like, I have to convince them. Like, I just don't care about making a big profit on it. Like, and this is way less risk, you know, the way I'm doing it with pre-orders. And then I order just a few more than what I've pre-sold. And like, I'm not really holding inventory, although that's starting to change. And it was just more of like a striking your own path and kind of this idea that when we started out, it equated to me of like selling your cassette tapes after the show out of the back of your car rather than like opening a store, you know? And like things have changed a bit. I think that was definitely more true when we were doing fewer games and not like a specific genre of games, and was kind of like, oh, here's another weird thing that we came across that we'll sell. With the trick taking now and setting up the web store, which we didn't have originally, it's becoming a little more not traditional, where like I'm still using the same printing methods, but like I do hold inventory now. I am ordering more copies, because what'll happen with these games is like I'll sell a few, you know, up to 200-300, and then they'll get out there, and then people are like, oh, I just found out about this game that came out last year. I missed the Kickstarter. Are there any available? And my answer was always, no, we sold out. Like that whole plan was to like sell it, and then when it's gone, I go on to the next thing. Well, now that I'm doing just these trick takers for like $20 a pop, it's a little easier and they're smaller, and I can just kind of keep an extra 100. And then when somebody buys the new one, they go, oh, I don't have that. I can add that on. So I'm getting more of these, like the older games are selling a little slowly, but there's still like, there's a venue to sell them. So I feel like I'm just rambling. I'm sorry. I think I lost my train of thought. But yeah, so, you know, it's, I think everything evolves, right? Like even punk rock record labels evolve and just kind of take on more as they get more comfortable. So yeah, there we are.
Oh no, that's really neat. There's a lot to kind of latch onto. I think the way you described it, to me, you know, makes a lot of sense. And I don't know, my brain is in like two spots at once, but nonetheless, oh no, I was just going to say, when you're like, oh, I'm rambling, I said, my sentiment is that if my questions don't allow for rambling, then I'm not doing a good job with the questions. So
fair enough.
Okay, here's the thing. So I think that, you know, we've talked about like trick taking a little bit, and I think, you know, obviously trick taking now is pretty popular. It's kind of one of the more in vogue things, but you know, different trick takers are doing different things, and I think there's kind of this idea of like there are a few main types of general mechanisms in trick takers, and then, you know, a game will have like a twist or this mm-hmm. or that. So a goal for some of my episodes goal for all my episodes is to make them like turbo specific, intentional, and all that. Sometimes I'll incorporate a little wrinkle or twist to accomplish that. So here's one for you for that. Here's a twist that I'm pulling on you.
Okay.
Okay, but it's not too much, I promise. And this is an audio only format, so the audience cannot see me. But I'm not punk rock. I mean, I don't think I've got the hair, but I'm
sure.
I don't think there's too much that's punk rock about me. But I don't know. I in terms of things I'm interested in and styles, I don't know, I'll do whatever. So, but I. I I'm not like turbo familiar with like the punk rock scene in general. So what I'm asking for you to do is to create a punk rock starter set of sorts.
Oh
And okay, and this isn't like the internet, you know, well, you'll see like one of those memes and it'll just be like the stereotypical ones, but more of a personalized one for you. All right. So I have some categories and you don't have to answer all of them. I have six categories. So for a few of them, let's just say three. You could answer all. I don't really care. It's 100% up to you. You could pick like a favorite or kind of like the introductory questions. You could pick something in the categories that's like more formative for you that you feel has like influenced your tastes in general. Like
Okay.
and honestly, the categories could be bad. I think the number one thing that would make sense would be music. So, you know, like bands or musicians. But otherwise, some of the other categories you could think about would be like movies, shows, books, clothing, and then I have a pretty catch-all in other. So
Okay.
you're creating a punk rock starter set with some of your favorites or formatives
So are we
or
talking
whatever.
like literal punk rock? Or are we talking about like a punk attitude in the more general sense of like, because punk can mean a lot of things, right? Like, and I honestly like, so I went to a lot of punk and ska shows when I was in high school, but then I haven't really kept up musically with it. And I've probably forgotten a lot of what I used to listen to. But I feel like there's this kind of like internal punk idea that I kind of hold on to. That's a little harder to like put into words, but so give me those categories again.
We can slow it down. So, and you can, I think what you said works well. So capturing that attitude, but we've got
Sure.
music,
Yeah.
movie, show, book, clothing, and other.
Okay. All right. So I feel like I'm putting my credibility on the line here. But so the first thing that jumps out to me music-wise, and maybe okay, I'm gonna say Operation Ivy. There's like one album that kind of covers all of their like releases. And that's when I think, you know, I want to listen to some punk. That's usually what I'm gonna put on. It's got a little bit of a ska influence as well. And then one of the guys in Op Ivy went on to be kind of a lead in Rancid, which is another band that I would probably go to. It's a little, I mean, it's not as like super underground as some folks who might be listening to will yell at me about, but that's all right. Movie wise, man, punk rock. Man, that's tough. I'm kind of thinking of like something, I will say like A24 as a production house, right? Feels pretty punk to me. I'll pretty much see anything they put out, and it's pretty offbeat and really makes you like question things, which I think is cool. So not a specific movie, but like A24 as like a film studio, right? What's a good punk show? Oh, the Doom Patrol.
Ooh,
Feels
nice.
pretty punk. I think that's a good one. Super weird. Book. James Vandermeer's Area X series. So like Annihilation, which they did a movie of, and then the other two that come after it, which I'm blanking on. But it's the Area X trilogy. I think he's kind of a punk author, just in general, doing just weird stuff. And then for clothing, man, you can't go wrong with a hoodie. Sweatshirt feels like the punk wardrobe to me. But yeah, how was that? Was that
You,
adequate?
yeah, I you were hesitant. I mean, not hesitant to start, but I think there I threw a lot at you, and yeah, you knocked that out of the park. So it's funny. I
Right.
definitely musically not familiar. A24, for sure. Yeah,
Yeah.
I used to watch way more movies than I do now, but I think that fits the bill really well, and. Yeah, so my wife and I watched a lot of those, comic inspired shows or what have you, but that have like, maybe like a darker twist. So I think, Doom Patrol is one of them. But we watched Umbrella
That
Academy
was another one I was just thinking of too. Umbrella Academy is great.
and unfortunately we stopped watching Doom Patrol somewhere in season two, I think. And I don't know. It just kind of happens. But I liked it. There was that one episode, and I don't think this is a huge spoiler, but it was that kind of the creator and recreator and decreator episode, if you know what I'm talking about. And that was one of like the most I've ever laughed watching a television show in my
Yeah.
entire life. I just was dying.
I mean, I think I'm really like, I love stuff that just isn't afraid to embrace the weird and just lean into it. And that feels pretty punk to me. It's just so like that no fear of just kind of being a weirdo and being into weird stuff, you know? So one of the things I really love about kind of some aspects of Japanese culture too is that they're just like they just jump in there, man, with the weird shit. And like they're just not afraid to just embrace it. So
Yeah, well, and I think, it's, ultimately, if it's like what you, like a very general you, if it's like what you want to do and you feel like you're being held back by anyone else's opinion, that's kind of sad. Not kind of sad,
Agree.
it's super sad. So
Agreed.
awesome. Okay, well, I'll definitely, now that I'm gonna hop back now. I have a movie list, and some of them are on, or a lot of my movie lists are some of the A24 films that I've missed. Do
Cool.
you have like, what's okay? Sorry, I'm just gonna ask another follow-up question. I know you
Yeah.
said you didn't have a particular one, but if you're gonna think of an A24 movie that sticks out to you as one that, if you were to have to watch one right now, what would you pick?
I mean, Hereditary probably is like one of my favorite horror movies I've ever seen, and it's just like, oh, it's so gonzo, but it's so good. Yeah, so I would say Hereditary first off the bat. I need to watch it again too. It's been a bit, but actually, there's a membership for A24. It's like a fan club kind of thing, and I got an email. My birthday was last week, and I got an email that they're sending me a birthday present, and you can choose from like one of six things, and one of the things was like a deluxe Blu-ray of The Green Knight, which I'd seen in the theater last year, actually. So I have that coming. Should be arriving today, which is pretty awesome. So I'm excited to watch that one again too. But like, yeah, I mean, there's so many different movies and they all do different things and they're all just, I don't know. I'm never disappointed with the A24 movie.
Yeah, I just clicked on their wiki to see which ones I'm missing, and holy smokes, there's like an absurd
Oh, there's
amount of
so
movies
many.
out.
Yeah,
It's
yeah.
like
I printed out the list at one point because I was curious and I was like, oh, I want to watch more of them. And I just realized how many there are. And it's just, yeah, it's bananas.
right, well, I've got a lot of things on the to-do list, but I'll add that for sure.
Yeah. Oh, I saw the TV Globe. That was really good. Civil War was really good. Like, I don't know. I just, whenever there's a new movie, I just go see it. Men was really good. I remember seeing that a couple years ago. Anyway, yeah, I could just rattle them off, but.
Yeah, I think looking at the list, I think the one that sticks out to me is, I wouldn't say necessarily the most impactful, but one that stuck with me the longest was probably The Lobster.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's funny because I was thinking of Yorgos Lanthimos first off when you said like punk rock movies. His stuff is yeah, super important. Have you seen Poor Things? That was his
No,
latest. Yeah,
that I
it's
actually
wild.
just did tell my wife that. I was wanting to watch that though.
Same director. Yeah, it's really good too.
All right, well that'll get bumped even higher. They'll
All
just
right.
endlessly bumping stuff from each other's
Oh, I know.
spots.
There's too much.
Awesome. Well, no, I love those responses and got some music to look into and some more things to watch again now.
Awesome.
Okay, so like I said, here's where things I think are kind of like going backwards a little bit. But between designing running Newmill and doing the publishing, and you know, we kind of mentioned it a little bit earlier, but doing more and more with Newmill, expanding mm-hmm. that with the Little Dog Games. You're starting the Indie Games Night Market.
Yep.
Life and everything else. Do you feel like there is one of those things that you're focusing on most, primarily in the game space, and do you feel as if like the balance has changed there?
I mean, I'm definitely doing more on the publishing end and like negotiating other games to put out that I am designing. I used to be much more focused on designing. I still have a couple of things that I'm kicking around, but I'm definitely spending more time on publishing and like the graphic design side of it, right? Because I do all the graphic design for everything, unless I'm reprinting stuff that using the original, which I am doing. There's a couple this fall that are kind of more like reissues than full new editions. But even that, like I have a lot of work to do, just kind of getting stuff ready for production. So that's probably most of my time. I do still have a couple of games that I'm working on. So there's some playtesting there, but it's a lot less than it used to be. And then, yeah, the Indie Games Night Market thing right now is kind of not on hold, because it's like, I put up invitation for applications, and then I'm waiting like till the end of the month, and then we got to move forward with stuff. So that's kind of, I don't have much to do with that right now, but that will be, I will have more, that's going to take more of my time, I think, in August probably, as I get stuff a little more ready for that. But yeah, I think the majority of Newmill time is spent on graphic design and production stuff.
Very cool. So yeah, I had this question in my head, but I didn't put it down, so it's kind of coming back to me. But how would you kind of like to describe the process of either, you know, like, you know, kind of having people come to you, you know, with game designs through, you know, community and people that you know, as opposed to, I know some of the things that you've done with Newmill are like kind of like seeking out to like get games like republished mm-hmm. and more mm-hmm. accessible and bringing them, you know, to different places and everything like that. But I guess, how would you describe that process overall?
Yeah, so I don't really take pitches. And I don't like to plan things out more than about a year in advance, which is one of the reasons I don't want to be inundated with pitches and like try to deal with all that. I mostly want to work with people I know, just because I do things a little looser than most publishers. And like, because we work a little differently, I want people to fully understand like what the process is going to be. So I am in contact with a few folks in Japan, and I've gotten to know some designers there. And because I started making connections, I can kind of get in touch with more people, which is because in Japan, like they don't really like to work with outsiders unless they have a good like relationship with them, or like people can vouch for them, right? Not by and large, like not, I'm not saying everybody was like that, but that's kind of the experience that I've picked up on. So it's a combination of finding, what I want to do is find like older Japanese trick takers that people are excited about that are out of print, that I can then make new versions of and make them available again. And that's probably about 2/3 of what I'm doing with Newmill. And then the other bit, I'm on a couple of Discords with a bunch of other designers in this space, and I play their games. And sometimes it's like, I'll play their game. It's like, do you have a plan for this? Are you pitching it? Because if not, like, I would love to do this as a Newmill game. I think it would kind of fit what we're doing. So it's that combination of like finding the stuff from Japan that I can reissue, and then like kind of giving opportunities to kind of newer trick taking game designers in the US that I've gotten to know mostly. I'm kind of still sticking to that, just because like my publishing agreement isn't fully vetted by lawyers or anything, right? Like it's more of like a handshake plus. So like, and again, like it's kind of a punk rock thing, right? Like I'm not, yeah. So it has to be, I have to have like a relationship with folks in order to kind of move forward with things. But yeah, so that's pretty much it. So it's like 2/3 reprints or like reissues, and then a third, like kind of bringing up newer unpublished US designers. Or folks that are on that server who have had published stuff, but they have weirder things that other publishers may not be interested in. Because like I'm fine doing 300 copies, 400 copies of something. Whereas most publishers, like they won't do it unless they can think they can sell like 1500, 2000. So I kind of look for that weirder stuff that has more of a niche interest that I can satisfy.
Oh, that's awesome. And yeah, it's kind of funny, like not funny. It's just interesting how, you know, both of those, you know, ideas or things that you work on have that, you know, relationship and community aspect, one of them more global or overseas, and the other one just kind of, you know, building it up through the relationships that you already have and just trying new things and finding, you know, the right audience for that, and, or just, you know, having to get out there and then realizing that there is kind of more audience. Like you said, a lot of times those games will come out and people will be asking like, oh, like, is this, is this available? And
I still get questions for stuff that, I don't have anymore. And I've started doing reprints, but it's tricky because the interest in a reprint is usually a lot less. So like, the 6 of 8 sold out basically before, like right after I started fulfillment, like I maybe after, so we did the pre-orders, I ordered a certain number, we kept taking orders. And by the time I got it, I think we had like 10 copies unclaimed of the 500 that I bought, which was bananas. So then, you know, there was a little more interest. So I was like, well, I'll go ahead and do a reprint order, but I've done, I think I could actually look, it's been less. I mean, I did a 300 copy reprint order. And I think we're at, sorry, this is not great podcasting. So about half of those have sold of the 300 I just purchased. So, and you know, I did another one for Enemy Anemone and it's been less than that, but I also have this web store and people will likely order it, add on to things as time goes on. I don't mind sitting on them a bit. Mm-hmm. But it's tricky. Like I'd always said before, like I wasn't going to do reprints. So it was going to be one and done. And even in the publishing agreement, I give the rights back to the designer as soon as it's done, as soon as it's fulfilled. Cause that was always the intention. It's like, here's 300 copies of a weird thing, onto the next. Right. But now with this trick taking stuff, it seems to make more sense to kind of hold a little more and like, let the interest build from the first print, from the first, like release of it, and then just have more to sell, you know, when word gets around. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah. I mean, and you talked about it earlier. I mean, you mentioned the fact that what you're doing is an evolution. So just, you know, of going, working with that ebb and flow and just seeing what works best. And having the, you know, the positive relationships with everybody that you're working with in the first place, it's, you know, it's going to be a good thing no matter what, you know, it's just in the best interest of everybody involved. So that's fantastic.
And I'm trying to like read the interest as I'm going forward. And like, we used to just do one game every 4 months. And now I'm doing like, I think this in the spring, I had 5 games available for pre-order. In the fall, I'm going to have 4. And as long as people are still interested and like, I'll keep putting stuff out, you know? But again, like it'll ebb and flow depending on, you know, what sells and where the interest is. I'm really hoping that this isn't like a bubble of trick taking and like people will be like, I have enough now, because that'll just end the company. But we'll see. Hopefully not. But that's why I don't plan more than about a year out, because I don't want to get stuck like with commitments that are just not going to go anywhere for me. So,
yeah. And, you know, I think, yeah, I just, you know, for my own personal taste. And I think, you know, as you're seeing with the people that are buying your game, there is an interest in finding stuff that isn't, you know, the usual, finding stuff that is a little more out there. Like, I don't know, to me, just like as a consumer, I think I'm, you know, more willing to, you know, take a risk or take a chance on something that's trying, as opposed to like doing something, doing the exact same thing with just a different coat of paint or whatever.
Yeah. And that's what I'm counting on, right? Like that there are enough of folks like you that will still be interested in this for a while. So
that's fantastic. Okay, so I kind of have just one follow-up question to that, you know, the balance of the things that you're working on as like with the designing and the publishing. Mm-hmm. So what would you say that your kind of current decision space for deciding whether a game you design is something that like you want to publish as opposed to something that you want to try to get published elsewhere?
That is interesting. And I do wrestle with that. So I'm still designing like trick-taking games for the most part. I've got a couple right now. And I think I just always assume that I will do it myself unless there's interest. But the only person I really show it to is Joe from Allplay. I just have a relationship with him, and like I'm talking to him pretty often. And every once in a while, I'll be like, "Hey, do you want to take a look at this?" Because he's one of the publishers that is also putting out a lot of trick taking. So I'll just show it to him when I see him, and then he'll kind of get back to me or not. Like I have one right now that he's considering, but I have another one that like it would be weird for them to do because of what you would need to include in the box. So I have a trick taking game that's I'm actually going to do. I'm going to release at Indie Games Night Market for the first time. It is a shared hands partnership trick taker, but you're sharing hands with your opponents. So it requires card stands. I'm not going to sell those card stands. That would be too expensive. But if somebody like Allplay wanted to do it, they would, right? Because they can't count on people to already have that kind of thing. But I can do that. I can be like, yeah, if you want to play this, you need card stands. Here's where you can get them. You can't get them from me. Good luck. And that'll be fine. I'll be fine with that. And my, yeah. I feel like my customer base would also be okay with it. Right. Like I can get away with that. But Allplay probably couldn't. So that's why I was going to do it that way. But I have another game that I am considering doing through them. And if they don't want to do it, then I'll just do it myself. And it's really not that big a deal. Like I have the infrastructure. It's very easy for me to just add it to whatever my kind of sneak it in with another group of games. And I have that flexibility. So yeah, I guess it just depends. I don't mind, I'll make more money if I give it to somebody else to publish who can do a lot more copies. But I'm also fine just doing things myself.
That's neat. Okay. This question definitely wasn't in my head because I didn't know about the shared partnership opponent thing. So this is something, if you were going, this is a stupid question, so I apologize in advance.
No, it's okay.
I do have, actually, oh my goodness, my room is in complete disarray, but somehow right next to me, look at this, I got three cards
nice.
Stand. So this I could play.
You would need one more.
I would need
total
one more.
Four. Yep.
Yeah. No, I bought one for my favorite color, my wife's and my brother's. So I just have to get like a random one.
Yep.
Say if I need to make a random one, what would be the best object to make an impromptu card stand?
Empty card stand. Oh man. I mean, I have a 3D printer at home, so I would probably design something and 3D print it. That's what I would do. But they're also like super cheap on Amazon. You can get like a set of card stands for like $15 or something.
Mm-hmm.
What would you use impromptu wise? I don't know, man. That is a weird question, Ryan.
I know. I've embraced the weird, all right?
Yeah, yeah. I appreciate it. No, I didn't say it was bad. Weird is not bad. You could take like two game boxes and like stick your cards, like push them together and then like stick your cards in between them, or a couple of books, something with a little bit of height that you could just kind of wedge the cards in between. That would work pretty well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, here. So I showed you my copies of Charms, Inflations, and then Enemy. And I have Charms and Inflation next to each other. I'm just putting the cards.
Yeah, that works.
It's perfect. All right.
Yeah. Something just straight and have a, it's something that has a little bit of weight so it doesn't move around too much.
So instead of like pitching, selling, card stands, you could just say buy more of my games.
Yeah, there you go. Use the boxes.
Use the
perfect.
Boxes.
Perfect. Best use.
Okay. All right. Well, that works. Okay. Well, we should. I mentioned like a twist. So like, I talked about, well, the twist in the episode was the punk rock starter kit set thing. So I just have two questions about games, and then we'll kind of get to some wrap up stuff.
Okay.
But what would you say is your favorite trick taking game that has like a pretty straightforward or kind of classic feeling that, just doesn't have like that wrinkle or twist or anything like that?
So Spades, I think, is my go-to answer for like a traditional trick-taking game that just is straight ahead but super satisfying. In fact, right before this, I played Spades like against the computer, like two hands of it or two games of it, just because I was like, I had an itch, and I played Spades with some friends online a couple days ago. But no, that one always hits for me. I also like, I want to explore more of like the kind of traditional German trick taking games. So like I, with Little Dog, I did a print run of Schafkopf that Cy Beppu had designed, a specific deck for Schafkopf. And I really want to play that one some more. And there was Konegrufen I played recently, a couple months ago, maybe. So these like hidden partnership, variable partnership bidding on how many trick, how many points, or how, you know, like there's restrictions on what you're trying to accomplish depending on how you bid. There's a lot of interesting stuff happening in those games that I haven't had enough experience with, but they seem really interesting to me.
Nice. Yeah, I haven't played Schafkopf, but yeah. I mean, okay, here, this is, my trick-taking knowledge is okay. So is there like a main, is it Sheep's Head, or is there like a main differentiation?
Schafkopf is German for Sheep's Head.
Okay.
I think there may be a slight difference in like how Americans play Sheep's Head versus Germans playing Schafkopf. Because like all of those traditional games have evolutions, right? Like people come up with house rules and then they teach those to other people. And then like, so they differ a bit. But yeah, no, Schafkopf is Sheep's Head as far as I know.
All right. Okay, I guess then I've definitely played some different hands of that.
Sure.
One of my probably more played games, especially growing up.
Oh, cool. And yeah, that's kind of Northern Midwestern, right? Sheep's Head.
Oh, yeah. Like that. And then you know, Euchre, which I don't think
I was going to say. Yeah, I played Euchre once, and it just felt like weird spades to me. I'm like, why would I choose to play this over spades? Just spades with weird rules. But yeah, I mean, Wisconsin, I imagine Euchre is a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then I started like looking into some of the different like whists out there. And I think I played one online, and it was good. It was what it was.
Yeah, whist is pretty. It's like your most straightforward trick taking, right? It's just like win as many tricks as possible. It's like the first team to get seven, I think, is the winner, right?
Yeah.
Of the hand. We played, I was at this trick taking convention this last February in Cincinnati, and we played this game called Military Whist, which was just whist, except you're playing with like, I think you can have up to like 30 teams or something. And every team has a country flag, and you're going and playing other countries. Like two of your team goes and two of your team stays at home, and you're basically playing a whist tournament with different countries, and you take their flag if you win, or you leave your flag depending on if you're home or away. And that was fun. I mean, whist is not that exciting, just because it's like, it's very straightforward trick taking, and you either have a good hand or you don't. But the giant tournament thing was a really fun way to do it.
So is there like a speed element to this? So like, if you get to places faster, no.
Okay. No, because you're like, you're doing them in rounds. So like, if you finish a game, you just go back to your table and you wait for everybody else to catch up, because then you have to find out who's playing who next and all of that. So, yeah, there was no speed to it. A lot of trash talk, though. That was.
Wonder like if that can be adapted into like a. I mean, obviously, it'd be limiting. You know, you want games to be like more accessible, and this would make it less accessible. But like, have like a physical speed element to the
game. Yeah, I'm sure somebody's done that, but I haven't played it.
Yeah, well, I probably wouldn't, but nonetheless, it'd be a thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so this doesn't necessarily have to be your favorite like game, but what would you say that your kind of favorite like twist in a trick taker is then? So we went from like the straightforward to what's like the wrinkle or thing that you think is the most interesting, whether it works well or not.
I mean, one of my favorites actually is Charms, that does the, you know, splits the suit and the rank on different cards and has you combining them. That's like one of my absolute favorites. So the fact that I got to publish a new version of it, which it was originally called Dois, which means two in Portuguese, absolutely blew my mind. It was one of the first. No, it's not exactly true. It's kind of the game that made me want to pivot fully into trick taking for Numil, and being able to publish that one and Zimbabwe Trick, which is kind of the opposite in that there are no suits really, just ranks, and you're playing them in front of yourself and they build up numbers. Just like, I mean, almost everything Taiki Shinzawa does is just like, he's kind of a deconstructionist, and he's like, well, what can I do to this and make it still be trick taking? It's just super cool. So I'm always interested in seeing what he's doing. So yeah, I mean, generally my answer is, what is Taiki Shinzawa doing? And that's what I want to see more of. But yeah, just the creativity coming out of the Japanese card game scene. It's just, it's wild. And it's cool to now like be part of that. Between like bringing games here and selling them when I go to Game Market, or republishing stuff. And I have games that are getting published in Japan now that I've designed. So like I'm seeing both sides of it, and it's just, it's wild that I'm now a part of that. So.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I know, yeah. So kind of thinking about, you know, your interest in, you know, the Japanese trick takers going to Tokyo Game Market, that's, you know, a lot of, well, and what you're doing with just your publishing in general is, you know, the inspiration for this indie games night market, yeah, which I think is like a really like fantastic idea. And I don't know if I, pardon my pun, play my cards right, I would love to be out there.
I don't travel
the most, but that'd be fantastic. And you know, I guess thinking about that for a second, you talked about it a little bit when just the application process, and that's what you're going to be working through in August, yep, a bit back. But I think, you know, provided that this first year, you know, kind of goes the way that you want or expect it to go, what do you think the ultimate goal or vision is for it? Provided, I mean, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, I'd love it to be its own thing, right? This is really kind of a pilot for the idea. You know, piggybacking off of PAX Unplugged, which is actually kind of one of the weirder board game conventions. Makes a lot of sense, I think. It's also very local to me. Philly's like a two-hour drive. So it's one that I often go to, mostly from proximity. So I think it's a really good fit for the start of it. But yeah, like down the road, even if I'm not doing it, if it catches on and somebody else decides they want to do like an indie games market similar to Tokyo Game Market, because that was the idea, right? Like bring that idea and that aesthetic and that ethos like to the States, because there's nothing really that exists for really small run, like really odd, you know, you don't know what you're going to find, you may never see it again kind of games, which is a shame because like there can be some really cool stuff that comes out of that. And the US market is very much like focused on retail stores and higher production and all of that stuff. So even just being able to foster the idea that there's value in these kind of weirder things, smaller runs, like I'd be totally fine if somebody else decided they wanted to do it as a large event. And I've actually already heard of a couple other people who are considering doing small ones around the country. So that's awesome. I don't need to own it as long as it's happening. Like I'm happy. So, but yeah, I know I'd love to see it become a bigger thing.
Awesome. Cool. Well, that's great. And that kind of will lead us to the final couple of wrap up questions. The last one is going to be, you know, we kind of mentioned some of the things that you're working on, but just in general things to look out for from you. Yeah. But before we get to that, my forever penultimate question is, just like a text that's been stuck on your mind. So I did make you come up with other things that interest you, but you know, what's something that you have watched or played or read or, you know, listened to recently that you're like, wow, that was really good?
We just started, there's a show called Counterpart. I don't remember when it came out. Let me see if I can look it up while I'm talking. Mm-hmm. But it was on Stars, I guess, and starred J.K. Simmons. And there's like this split reality. 2017 was when it was out, I guess. So it was a few years ago. And I watched it once before, but I just started rewatching it with my wife this week. And it's just, I don't know, that a lot of like nature, the nature of identity and self and like, there's a lot of stuff going on in it, but it's basically like 30 years ago, a scientific experiment went wrong and it's created us another reality that mirrored our own. But then over those 30 years, they've diverged. And now there's kind of tension between, and there's like this one government organization that's kind of managing, interfacing with the other world, and but like it's very tense and things are going awry. But I've been really enjoying watching that again, and there's a lot to kind of mull over after every episode. So that's really fun.
Yeah, that sounds like a show that definitely warrants a rewatch.
Yeah,
for sure. So, and like an odd Board Game Link, but I want to say that I saw like some video, I didn't watch it, that it showed J.K. Simmons and just doing some, you know, camping or RVing, and it was just him talking about like board games that he was interested in. So,
oh really?
Funny.
That's yeah. Wild.
If I think that exists, I don't think I'm making that
if
up.
If you find that, send it to me. I'd love to see it.
Yeah, I'll look like right after this. Okay, but yeah, so we talked about you know, that you kind of have a fall release, you know, maybe a game that you're going to be bringing to the Indie Games Night Market, the yep. reprint of Reapers.
Yep.
Is there anything else that people should be looking out for from you?
Oh my God, there's so much. I mean, there's so there were the five games that I made available in June.
Mm-hmm.
Two new ones, which are actually reprints of Japanese games, Seven Prophecies, Icarus Club, that share a mechanic, but they feel very different. And then there was the reprints of Enemy Anemone, which is now in the kind of standard new mill box, which is cool, and has a few more anemone cards in it, because I didn't need the rules cards because it's actual rule booklet. Reprint of Six of Eight, and then Spring Cleaning by Jonathan Cox, who has a very popular YouTube channel. It's his first published game, so that was really exciting to help him. We did that through Little Dog. So his wife actually organized the art and the graphic, and she did all the graphic design. And Little Dog stuff is like, you bring me all the finished files and I'll sell it for you and distribute it, but it's your thing. I'll do the back half. So it's a way for me to get more stuff out there without having to do it all myself, which is cool, and help friends like who want to do things themselves, but need a little help. So those were the five from the spring. This fall, it's three Japanese reprints. So, they're all super weird and a little spooky. So Somnia, which has all new art, which I'm really excited about. I worked with the illustrator who did Lunar for Allplay. Yep. And she was super awesome. And then Man-Eating House and Idle Hands are pretty much straight reprints using all the original art. And then I'm doing a reprint of Reapers and also in the new mill box. And I did new art for it. New graphic design for it, slight retheming. I'm really excited about that. It's looking really good. So that's October. And then I have stuff, you know, I mentioned my game agency, which is the shared hands partnership across the table game, which will be at Indie Games Night Market. And then I have three games planned for February and another couple already on the books for next June. So yeah, there's a lot. I'm kind of like, and it's like when to start working on the next thing, you know? So like, I just finished the rule books for 3 out of 4 of the October games this week. And then I have to do everything for the fourth one in the next couple of weeks, but I'm waiting on the new illustrations. There's two new illustrations the designer wanted to give me. So that's end of the month, I think. But yeah, it's just like juggling when to do stuff for what, you know, and not making sure I don't plan too far ahead, because you never know what's going to happen in a year. But yeah, a lot of cool stuff coming up. As long as people are still interested, I'll keep doing it.
Well, I mean, that is welcome news to me and I'm sure many, many other people. So I'll definitely link the web store, because a lot of those pre-orders and the other ones are still like available. Those,
yep.
Like,
yeah,
so games are.
Yep. I keep everything in pre-order until I actually get them and do fulfillment, and then they just become standard order.
Mm-hmm.
Right now I am out of town for like most of the summer, so I'm not going to be shipping anything until like mid to late August, whether it's in stock or not. And I have a big message about mm-hmm. that on the website. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, I will link that. I will be looking out for everything else that you're working on, and just a fun link. You mentioned Alicia. Alicia and I chatted a bit back, and
that's right.
You mentioned working with you, so that's great.
And, no, she's rad.
And just like a final quick anecdote before, you know, thanking you and signing off, is that, you know, I know I posted this online in one of the Discords that we mentioned, and that was just like one of my earlier experiences in playing Enemy Anemone. And you know, one of the people that I played a lot of games and card games growing up with was my dad, and he likes, I mean, he likes games, so he'll like anything that I bring over, but I typically kind of have to ask him like his thoughts on them. But after we play, he's like, oh, I really like that one. And it was just like a really nice, fun experience. It was a good night, you know, just being able to catch up with Pops and hang out and play that and just kind of like bring back the types of games that he likes. So,
yeah, it's surprising to me how well that game has gone over with like every segment of people. Like my mother-in-law loves that game and has like introduced it to her family, who then have bought copies, and like every time she has friends over, she like teaches them how to play. She's like ordered a bunch of copies from me, like over, like she's like, oh, you're reprinting it? That's so good. So like she's already ordered an extra copy. It's probably the most universal of my games, the most like wide appeal, which is pretty cool to see.
Yeah, it's super fun, and I know that you've kind of merchandised that. I have to get one of those shirts.
Yeah, there's a bunch of shirts. So that was funny. There was somebody who really liked the art, and they were like, "Oh, if you put these creatures on t-shirts, I will buy one of each." I was like, "Okay," and I did it, and then he did. So now they're all the different creatures up there, and then I did one recently that is the clownfish, and it says, keep your enemies close and your anemones closer. Or your friends close and your anemones closer. That's what it is. Keep your friends close and your anemones closer. Which I thought was funny. I've sold a couple of those. But those are just like, I don't make anything on those. It's just kind of for goofs. But yeah.
Oh, I like that a lot. Yep. Well, yeah. Like I know you got a ton going on, and I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to chat with me.
It's been fun. Yeah, it's been super cool. Thanks for having me on.
All right, perfect. Thank you.
Yep.
Intertextual Cardboard Experience, the most punk rock podcast about board games and any other text that they connect to. Thank you so much for choosing to spend your time here. Any further support, such as sharing the show with friends, following the page's socials in the episode description, writing a review, filling out the feedback form, or doing anything else you can think of is greatly appreciated. Keep playing, watching, reading, listening, experiencing.